The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. I apologize for the delay, but several of us, like several of you, I'm sure, had difficulty getting to wherever we were going today, the Capitol, in a timely fashion. And so our morning conference took a little longer. We have with us today, in another room in which this proceeding is being broadcast, the Loyal High School students. If they were in this room, I would ask them all to rise. So, although I can't see you, you can see me. You should rise. And I want to, on behalf of the court, welcome you to this presentation. The students are here with the Court with Class program. This is a program sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and the Supreme Court.
They can be seated, I think.
Oh, maybe I should tell them to be seated. Yes, thank you, Justice Bradley. The Loyal students should please be seated. The group is here with the Court with Class program. Students from all around the state are invited to participate with us and come and hear an oral argument. And if they agree to do that, they are sent briefs of the case and might do a variety of activities in relation to the case. They come to the court on the day of oral argument, and at noon, after the two cases are heard in the morning, they will meet with a justice, and a different justice meets with the students each day. And today, the high school students will meet with Justice Prosser in this conference room. The discussion is about the procedures of the court, not the substance of the case to be heard, and anyone who wishes to join the students may do so. With that said, I would ordinarily introduce the members of the court to the students, and so I will do that. And I'll start with my left, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. On my immediate right is Justice Patrick Crooks, and to his right is Justice Patience Grobensack. And there are three empty chairs of justices who will not be participating in this case. So with that said, I'll call our first case 03-0442-CR, State versus Charles Quala. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Quala is Attorney James A. Olson. Mr. Olson.
May it please the court, counsel, I'm Jim Olson, along with my partner, Dixon Gantz. We appear on behalf of the appellant defendant, Charles Quala, in this matter. I have met with the defense counsel who will be arguing the case following this, and we have agreed that I will be principally addressing my remarks to the issues of separation and powers and also speech and debate. They will be principally addressing the other areas raised in the brief. However, I will respond to any questions that the court has on the other matters that are covered in the brief. Three of the counts that have been alleged against Mr. Quala in this case allege that he was ordered various members of the Senate Democratic Caucus on state time to engage in campaign activities during the 1998 and 2000 election cycles. All of these members of the caucus had been hired before then and had performed the general policy making work of the caucus before the election cycle. The allegation of the other count is that Senator Quala offered a job to a lady to work with the Senate Democratic Caucus, which involved fundraising. The director of the caucus indicated in the complaint that she would also be doing policy work as well. This lady never took the job and was never paid anything by the state. None of the four counts allege that any of the work performed by the caucus employees was for Senator Qualen's campaigns. We believe this prosecution should be dismissed. These counts should be dismissed because they violate the concepts of separation of powers and speech and debate. The court is well aware of the concept of separation of powers. It's been before the court on a number of occasions. Basically, the concept is that we have three independent and equal branches of government, and one may not infringe upon the powers of the other unless it's expressly provided by law. The separation of powers doctrine is involved in this case because the state bases its prosecution upon the Senate policy manual. The rulemaking power, Article 4, Section 8 of the Wisconsin Constitution, gives to the Senate the sole power to adopt and enforce Senate rules. And that is why the separation of powers doctrine is invoked. Now, it's our position, and I won't be arguing this will come up in the subsequent argument, but it's our position that the court shouldn't even have to get to the separation of powers issue because the duties that Senator Qualo was supposed to have violated under the misconduct in public office statute are not defined by statute, and therefore prosecution should be dismissed there. But beyond that, it should be dismissed under the grounds of separation of powers. The rule
also, let me interrupt you if I may for a minute. Can you tell me, I'm not seeing the link yet. I understand the doctrine of separation of powers, but the duties and responsibilities of a legislator, are they set forth someplace? Is there some listing of those duties?
The opposition that there is not. The duties are not set forth in any statutes like the office of the sheriff and many other bodies.
And is it your position that no legislator, or at least no senator, can be prosecuted under this statute?
Well, I think a senator could be prosecuted under the statute if they, for example, if they sold their vote. One of their duties is to vote. That would be a discretionary
duty. Where is that?
Well, that would be part of the legislative responsibilities, would be the senator is elected to vote on issues.
All right. That's custom?
Well, I think it's certainly custom, but it's also part of, that they're elected to legislate. And legislation, the Constitution says that they're the legislative branch of the body. And legislation means you vote on legislation. So that is...
they'd be liable if I didn't look it up, but I assume that there's a bribery statute that might cover that, too.
Sure, there would be a bribery statute that might cover that.
So you can be covered under both this statute that's an issue here and another statute that created a crime.
Yes, I think the one that created the crime would probably be under sub 2 of the misconduct in public office.
Rather than sub 3 that we're dealing with here.
Sub 3.
Okay.
But as far as using a vote for to benefit yourself, I think could be covered under sub 3.
What's the discretionary power under sub 3? That's being alleged to have been violated.
I'm not really sure what the discretionary power is that is being alleged to be violated. I believe it is that he used his power as the head of the Senate and therefore the his power because he was really the head of the Senate Democratic Caucus to assign jobs relating to the campaign.
To hire and then assign tasks.
Hire and then assign work.
That was the discretionary power.
Yes.
In a manner inconsistent with the duties, and that you're just saying that there is no duty here not to campaign.
Yes. That's our position. That duty is not set out in statutes.
Is it your position that unless the duty is set out specifically in the statute that there is no duty?
As far as this case is concerned, the answer to that is yes.
Now let's have a little broader question.
Okay.
Is it your position that unless a statute sets out a duty, that there is no duty?
Yes, that would be the case. And in fact, let me address to the court the jury instructions, which deal with this particular section of the statute. And those jury instructions advise the jury that they are to determine whether he violated a duty, and there's a blank as to what is a duty. And the court is asked them to fill in the blank as to what that duty is. And if you go to the footnotes, it says something to the effect, tell which statutory section is involved.
How does that mesh then with your statement earlier in oral argument that there is a duty to vote? Are you able to give me a statutory reference to that duty?
I think that that's as far as the Constitution is concerned, as part of the legislative power, it just is assumed that a person has to vote.
So that duty isn't specifically set forth any place.
Well, I would say that duty is certainly a part of the Constitution. It doesn't say legislators shall vote, but of course it would be absurd to elect legislators who didn't vote.
So it's your position, and understandably so, because it makes sense, that inherent, although not specifically set forth in the statute or Constitution, inherent in the position of legislature is the duty to vote.
Yes.
What other inherent duties are there for the legislature or legislator, although not set forth specifically in the statute or Constitution?
I can't put my fingers on one right now.
Attend committee meetings?
Well, I don't think that's specifically set forth in any statute or in the Constitution. However, it could very well be a violation of the Senate rules, which would subject the person to punishment by the body itself under the Senate rulemaking power. And certainly, I mean, there also is a final issue of a remedy, and that's to the ballot box if a person consistently does not show up to committee meetings.
Mr. Olson, what's wrong with, in your opinion, the state's approach? As I understand the state's approach, the state would say, well, you can find the duties of a legislator by looking at the policy manual, the guidelines, chapters 11, 15, 19. And when you look at all of these things together, these duties and responsibilities become clear. What's wrong with that?
Well, I think that the duties and responsibilities do become clear because none of the statutes say that the senator has the duty to not have people participate in campaigns. When you look at the statutes one by one, I don't think any of those statutes cover the situation that we have here. The fact of the matter is the duties of a senator have not been spelled out in the statutes like the duties of many other people have.
Well, is your argument on separation of powers, and I'm back to my original questions, I guess, but is your argument on separation of powers that this court would have to interpret the policy manual, the Senate guidelines, that sort of thing? Is that where the separation of powers violation allegedly comes in?
Yes, yes. That you would be required to interpret an ambiguous Senate rule. And that would then intrude upon the rulemaking authority of the Senate.
And you're saying the ambiguous rules relate to terms like political activity, legislative activity, is that correct?
I would say that the ambiguous terms deal with political activity and the words working hours. But those are the terms which are ambiguous.
And why do you think working hours, that seems to be something that's a rather common term, why would that be ambiguous?
Because the Senate policy manual does not establish any working hours. It doesn't say that they should be and work from a certain hour to a certain hour. In fact, it says that the Senate staffers are really at the beck and call of the senators, and that they have to work whenever the senators have to work or whenever there is work to do, which means during budget times and periods of time when there is heavy legislation, they might work many, many, many hours and build up a lot of compensatory time. So there is nothing, working hours is meaningless. If it said, thou shalt be at, you know, you shall be at your workplace from 8 o'clock till 5 o'clock, then working hours would be set. But in this particular case, at least as far as the Senate caucuses are concerned, there were no set working hours.
But you think they have to work 8 hours a day unless they're off on compensatory time?
When I say
8 hours a day, I mean it could be at night.
I mean, I think that they average 8 hours a day, but there are no set working hours. And in fact, they're not given overtime if they work more than that, and so they get that with compensatory time. And that is, you know, another part of the problems in this case. So, excuse me.
Please.
Well, I was just going to continue on with the discussion on.
If you're continuing to a new area, then I will interject.
Why don't you go ahead. I was going to continue talking about separation of powers.
Okay. You're focusing now on the manual, and speaking of the ambiguity, in no political activity is permitted during working hours. As I understand, in part, the argument is because the language is ambiguous, certainly the argument is that the court cannot be construing the policy of the legislature. But let me take the second sentence of that manual provision. Because I think of working hours, I think that's, that your argument rings true to me. You can work from sun to sun, but sometimes, people's work is never done. And I think that's true when it comes to a lot of public officials. But the second sentence of that same provision, after the sentence that we've just discussed, which says no political activity is permitted during working hours, the second sentence says no state facility, office equipment, supplies, etc., may be used for political purposes at any time. So it seems to me that perhaps that second sentence escapes any arguable ambiguity with regard to the working hours.
I think it does. I think it does. It still has the ambiguity as far as the words political purposes are concerned. But it doesn't have the working hours ambiguity. The case closest in point on the separation of powers issue that we have discovered is the case of United States versus Rostenkowski. Out of the U.S. District Court in Washington. And that was a decision that was written by then-Judge Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And that case involved an allegation of misappropriation of funds by Congressman Rostenkowski regarding the use of his staff to do a variety of things. And there was a House rule. And the House rule was that the staff could be paid for official activities, but not for personal services. And Justice Ginsburg reviewed the acts that were alleged and for most part said basically that it was ambiguous, that she could see why there were why certain of the things could be determined to be official activities. And some of the things that were considered to be official activities were taking picking up Congressman Rostenkowski's kids, picking up laundry for Congressman Rostenkowski, and also campaign act, working on campaigns. Those were all considered things which could be considered official activities. And the court said, you know, we might be bending over backwards to find that these things could be considered official activities. However, we are loath to attempt to intrude on the rulemaking authority of the House, and therefore we are required to keep our hands off of these activities. And that was, you know, part of this. And when we come back to our situation, the word political activities, the chief clerk of the Senate wrote a description of what the work was that was done by the Senate Democrat, by actually by all the caucuses. And what you have to understand is the caucuses were, their very purpose was to be a partisan group. It wasn't a group like the Fiscal Bureau.
But when they started, it was the legislators did not have staff, personal staff. So this was centralized staff for policy.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And then it appears to have evolved into something else. And in the Rostenkowski case, and cases cited in it like Cannon and others, one of the main rationales, as I read the cases, was that Congress really hadn't quite made up its mind as to whether it was going to prohibit campaigning on government time or not. And so the public policy in some of these cases as to Congress was a little vague, and the courts therefore would not want to impose its view as to whether that is or is not on government time. Do you disagree with that reading?
No, I don't. I think that's the case where we are here today.
But isn't it different in Wisconsin? Because there is, seems as if the rules adopted by the Senate are clear about political campaigning. And maybe the argument is that you, that they're not in, not very good because you can't distinguish campaigning from public policy that a legislator does.
I totally agree with the last thing that you said.
I thought you might. But is that your position?
It's my position that the word political activity, which is the only words used in the Senate policy guidelines, which were adopted by the Senate, is so broad that you can't distinguish between one activity and another activity. And if I went back, excuse me, to the what the chief clerk of the Senate said relating to the what the caucus is, that it is a partisan political body, and its job is to help sharpen the issues in a partisan way so that the debate can be better focused, which is the way that is a healthy and important part of the legislative process. So they are designed to be a political body. And
Mr. Olson, let me interrupt you for a minute right at this point. My understanding is the Court of Appeals agreed with you to some extent that they saw some problems with political activity and said political activity certainly didn't involve things like monitoring press or monitoring press clippings or committee votes or committee discussion, that those were much more closely aligned with legislative activity. So it sounds as if they tried to limit the definition of political activity, and yet they still allowed the charges against your client to stand. So what specifically is alleged in regard to Senator Quala that's beyond the idea of political activity and into the legislative realm, if you will?
Okay. It's our position that everything kind of morphs one into another. You go from the campaign to the legislative session, and what you have is a senator is elected to legislate. And what campaigns are all about are to present before the people ideas that will become legislative ideas, and that the legislative process doesn't start the day that the session opens. The legislative process starts with an idea, and that goes back into the campaigns and sometimes before the campaign.
Are you saying that you can't compartmentalize, in other words, that you can't really separate political activity from legislative activity?
I'm saying that you cannot. That you could give definitions for both, and they might be somewhat different. But as far as we're concerned here, political activity and legislative activity, all the political activity was legislative activity. It was the, what a campaign is. A campaign is more than just electing a person. The candidate is really the courier of the idea. Once the campaign is over with, the idea doesn't necessarily die. In fact, that's the purpose of campaigns. The idea continues to live, and it becomes part of the legislative process. And the reason why many people support candidates in campaigns is because of their ideas, their hopes that legislation, if the ideas they express, will turn to legislation. And so to try to compartmentalize and cut off one and say that another is something else is really not the way the system works. Now, that does not mean that the Senate could not, by its rules, if they felt that there was a compelling state interest, come down and develop rules which would specifically state what a person can and cannot do when they are employed by the state. However, if they were to do that, that would have to withstand strict scrutiny. That would have, the particular rule would have to be narrowly drawn to determine, to deal with the problem that the legislature saw to exist. And that hasn't been done in this case. That hasn't been done by the legislature.
Now, there are statutes about not using state property to raise campaign funds, right?
There are other statutes dealing
roughly in that area, yes.
Right. Since political activity and legislative activity are so close and interrelated, as you state, can a legislator ever be found as violating the statute?
I guess I'd have to look at the specific statute. I think probably if a legislator ordered somebody to use state property to do a certain thing which was prohibited by the statute, yes, I think the legislator could be found guilty of that. Or if it's an interpretation of a House rule, of a Senate rule, he could be punished by the Senate, expelled. Or the Senate has a number of different possibilities. However, unless it's determined that that's a duty, it wouldn't be a violation of 946.12 sub 3.
Is it a duty of all public officials to adhere to the law?
Well, it's a duty to, of course, it's a duty to adhere to the law, but you have to show a particular law that they have violated in order for them to be found guilty of it. I mean, people can be punished by the Senate as well as by in the criminal case, and in some cases, that's the only place where they can be punished. I see my red light is on.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. You will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Assistant Attorney General Barbara Oswald, representing the state of Wisconsin.
May it please the Court, I'm Assistant Attorney General Barbara Oswald. I represent the state of Wisconsin, who is the respondent in this matter. The state asks this Court to hold that defendant Charles Koala can properly be prosecuted for misconduct in public office, for his alleged use of state employees and other state resources for the personal benefit of individual candidates and campaign organizations. Specifically, the state is asking this Court to hold, first, that the defendant fails to prove that the statute is unconstitutionally vague as applied to the facts of this case. Second, that the prosecution for the alleged conduct does not violate the speech or debate clause because the activity engaged in here is not integral to the legislative process. And finally, that this prosecution does not violate the doctrine of separation of powers because the state is not interfering with the due functioning of the legislature or trying to interpret or impose a legislative rule upon the legislature.
Can I talk about overbreath, too?
The defendant has not raised the issue of overbreath in this appeal. I will address that issue in the second case.
Okay. Is the speech in debate, was it raised in this case that was waived? I forget, was it this case or the next case where that was argued that it was waived because it wasn't part of the petition for review?
I don't know the answer to that question. It was not briefed in either the Court of Appeals or in this Court with respect to the Jensen case. It's only been briefed in this particular case.
Ms. Oswald, let me ask you a couple of questions in regard to the way you opened by indicating that the defendant had failed to meet his burden of establishing the unconstitutionality of the statute. My understanding, and it's tough because some of these things overlap, as you know, but it's my understanding that there is an argument, and I believe it's in the second case, that the burden really is on the state, that the burden is not on the defendant when you get into areas such as vagueness and allegations that a statute is overbroad. How do you respond to that?
I think it's a creative argument that doesn't have any merit. And I can address this in a later case.
I feel strongly about that,
counsel. I feel strongly about that. The case law is very clear when somebody is challenging the constitutionality of a statute, whether it be on its face or as applied, they have the burden of showing that it's unconstitutional. The burden does shift to the proponent of a statute when there are First Amendment rights implicated. However, there is an initial duty on the person who is invoking the First Amendment to show that the First Amendment even applies. And as I will discuss in the second case, unless the Court wants me to address it now, the First Amendment just isn't implicated in the facts of this case.
And briefly, and I don't want to take you further on this, but briefly, is that because conduct is at issue?
That is correct, Your Honor. It's because conduct is being regulated, not speech. The defendant in this case and in the subsequent case would have the Court believe that they are being prosecuted for infraction of a minor, obscure work rule, and nothing could be further from the case. This case is not based solely upon a legislative rule or a legislative handbook or legislative policy manual. As the documents from the Senate make clear, the Senate policy that says that no political activity can be engaged in on state time or with state resources is based specifically upon statutes that exist, particularly 11.36, which is in the campaign finance laws. And that rule, which is based upon statute, is very clear. And the Senate guidelines, which the state included in its appendix, are very, very clear. They're crystal clear.
What subsection of 1136 are you relying on, Counselor?
The Senate policy manual and the Senate guidelines do not make reference to the specific statute. It makes reference only to 11.36.
Right.
They do not articulate. Correct. But I believe that 11.36 subsection 1 is at issue, and also 11.36 subsection four, and let me just verify that.
One is solicitation, okay?
Correct.
And sub four is, again, entering a public place for the purpose of requesting or collecting a contribution. Are we now limited to only those activities that involve money if you're going to rely on 11.36, or are we interpreting people's use of state telephones or whatever as money as well?
I think there are several different types of conduct that are prohibited by 11.36. Subsection 1 deals with the solicitation of an employee to engage in any service for political purposes, not just soliciting a campaign contribution. The other sections, subsection 3 and subsection 4, deal with restricting people from entering or remaining in public offices for the purposes of soliciting campaign contributions. So there are different types of conduct which are prohibited by that statute. And I would like to add, as an aside, there's been some discussion about the fact that some of the statutes that the state relies upon were enacted after the misconduct statute was enacted. There's nothing that prevents the state from relying upon subsequent statutes to determine a duty. However, I would like to point out that 11.36 existed in a previous form since 1905, and that statute in 1905 was enacted to prohibit a state official or state employee from soliciting any service or contribution from another state employee or official for a political purpose. So that
which is defined, an act done for the purpose of influencing the election or nomination for election of a person to national office.
Which, I'm sorry, which section is the court referring to?
11.36.5.
That's correct. I think that section broadens the definition of political purpose to include candidates for national office. The other
includes, not means.
Correct. Okay. So the more broader definition in 11.01 also applies. So the argument that the state is relying on some new duty that has been enacted after the enactment of the misconduct statute is absolutely wrong. And it's important to note that 11.36 in its original form applied specifically to state public officials, and it was later broadened to include other people, but that duty has existed since 1905. So this argument that the state is relying on a legislative work rule and nothing more for the purposes of the prosecution is just not right. The state has enumerated numerous statutes in its brief, and the Senate guideline and the Senate policy manuals draw upon those statutes when they are summarizing the prohibition on using state resources and state employees for political purposes.
The defendant's position, as I understand it, is that the state is cobbling together a mishmash of statutes. Some just state public policy, others state thou shalt not. And that from that collection in Chapter 11, Chapter 15, Chapter 19, that you're getting a duty. And that, one, you can't cobble. You got to find it precisely. And two, if I understand their position, and two, that none of these statutes are so clear about the legislators. What do you say?
I say two things. One is that there are numerous duties that are set forth in these statutes. The conduct alleged here violates each of those duties. The state has chosen to summarize it or put it under the penumbra of a prohibition on the use of state resources or state employees for campaign purposes. But, in fact, a legislator has a duty to refrain from using his public office to obtain an unlawful benefit, advantage, or privilege for himself or others. That's 19.45. He has a duty to refrain from using the perquisites of public office to gain a campaign advantage over those non-incumbent candidates who don't have access to state resources. He has a duty to refrain from soliciting state employees to perform services for political purposes as part of their official duties. That's 11.36 subsection 1. He has a duty to refrain from making state employment contingent upon the performance of political campaign activities. That's 12.07 subsection 4. He has a duty to prohibit anyone from entering or remaining in a state office for purposes of soliciting or receiving a campaign contribution.
Counselor, could we go back to 11.36 for just a minute, please? 11.61 says that certain types of violations of Chapter 11 can be criminal conduct. And if you look at 11.36, it identifies it as a misdemeanor, not a felony. But if you're going to use 11.36 here and you're charging him with felony misconduct in office, can you explain to me how you fit those two concepts together, please?
Absolutely, Your Honor. The defendant in this case, Senator Quayle, is being charged with exercising a discretionary power with that is inconsistent with the duties of the office with the purpose of gaining a dishonest advantage. We look to a misdemeanor statute which sets forth a duty for that office to determine whether or not his conduct in exercising his power for a dishonest advantage was inconsistent with the duties of this office. The fact that some of this conduct might be criminalized under a different statute does not mean that the prosecution cannot choose to go under the felony statute.
Well, even the sections that you're using, that you're cobbling together, if you will, from 11 and 15 and 19, some of those are not criminal in terms of penalties, but rather involve forfeitures, do they not?
Correct, Your Honor.
Now, I recognize that this gets into what you want to talk about in the second case, but isn't that a problem for you in jumping from a forfeiture to a felony charge?
No, I don't believe it is, because the legislature chose to make a felony the exercise of a discretionary power inconsistent with the duties, whether those duties be set forth by statute, whether those duties be inherent in the office, whether those duties be set forth in some other place. The reason that this is the felony is because it meets the elements of the felony misconduct statute. It is not just a violation of those particular statutes. We just look to those statutes in order to define one particular element or to determine the element in that case. And certainly the trial court could, in drafting the jury instructions, set forth all of these duties for the jury, and the jury gets to decide whether or not the conduct engaged in is inconsistent with those duties. We have chosen to summarize it as a duty to refrain from using state resources and state employees on state time. However, we could separate out those duties specifically and put them in a jury instruction if that is what is more appropriate. But that doesn't mean the statute is vague. It doesn't mean that this is a violation of separation of powers.
Counselor, if your argument is correct, when would you ever violate 11.361 and not end up getting charged with a felony?
Someone could violate that statute without exercising a discretionary power of their office. They could do so even exercising a discretionary power of their office, but not doing so with the intent to gain a dishonest advantage. That is what makes it misconduct. It is the abuse of the official position and the official office to gain a dishonest advantage. So there will be situations where people may solicit somebody to engage in campaign activity on state time, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they are exercising an official power, discretionary power, or that they're doing so with the intent to gain a dishonest advantage.
Well, if the power, and I understand what was identified by opposing counsel earlier, the power is the power to hire people and direct their activities, correct? And if you exercise that in a discretionary way, you tell them to do things that are lawfully the business of the Senate. If you tell them to do things that violate 11.36, then you've unlawfully exercised your discretion, if I understand what you're saying. Well, if that's the case, and you've told them to do things they're not supposed to do in violation of the statute, I don't see where the prosecutor's ever going to charge him with a misdemeanor if he can charge him with a felony under the statute you're using.
Well, I do believe there are situations where that could happen. I'm not...
But the dishonest advantage is to try to get someone to work on a campaign that you want to succeed and use state resources, right? I mean, that's the dishonest advantage.
Correct.
And that's the same thing that 11.36 is after, but 11.61 says it's a misdemeanor when you violate 36. But you pushed it now up into a felony because you say it's for a dishonest advantage. But I can't imagine any other reason why anybody would be doing this stuff except to get somebody elected they wanted elected. Is there something else that I'm missing?
Well, for one, the statute could be violated by certain sections of the statute could be violated by somebody who does not hold a public office.
Okay.
Second of all, there are different statutes that could be charged with respect to the same conduct, some of which have more severe penalties. Obviously, it's the discretion of the executive branch to determine what the appropriate statute is. There might be a situation where somebody engages in this type of behavior one time, fairly innocently, and it's appropriate to charge them with a misdemeanor. But when it's done on a grand scale, as it was in this case, then obviously felony prosecution is more appropriate.
Okay. Thank you. Now, all of these sections that you say are duties, you have had to turn them around because they're not duties. They are prohibitions. Thou shalt not do. So the real duty is you have to obey these statutes. That's the duty, I suggest.
I don't know that that's necessarily true. 19.45, subsection 5 and subsection, I believe, 2, and also 19.46 is phrased in the negative duty, thou shalt refrain from doing. So I don't know that that is a significant distinction.
Counsel, then, as I understand it, the prosecution, of course, is under 946.12, sub 3, and one of the elements in that charge is there has to be established a duty, and that in describing what a duty is, in defining what the duty is, you look to other statutes to give you the definition of duty that then is, if you will, plugged in to 946.12. That's what you're doing. Is that correct?
In this case, we can point to numerous statutes that form the duties that have been violated in this case. I don't know that that is always the case. I think there are inherent duties in office. And if the misconduct in public office statute is limited to only those officials and employees who have statutorily enumerated duties, then this statute does not apply to most officials and employees that work for the public. For example, if I were to refuse to file a criminal complaint within the period of statute of limitations, and I did so with the distinct intent to save a buddy or a family member from criminal prosecution, I believe that would be misconduct in public office because I am exercising a discretionary power that is the power to charge an individual with the intent to gain a dishonest advantage for that person, and it is inconsistent with the duties of my office. Yet there is no statute that sets forth those specific duties that I have to file a criminal complaint within the statute of limitations or that I have to charge at all. So there has to be some recognition that there are inherent duties that are so fundamental to the office that that can be violated by the statute, and they do not have to be defined by statute. Now, is that the case here? We have all of these statutes that we can point to as evidence of duty, as notice that what these defendants were doing was wrong, which they admitted that they knew they should not be doing. So we don't have a case where the court has to delve into, well, whether it was this an inherent duty, is there an inherent duty. We did discuss the fiduciary duty. You owe your public position to the public, and it's a position of trust, but we don't even have to go that far. We can look just to specific statutes, particularly the general duties of public officials, which is what Chapter 19 is.
We haven't talked a lot about separation of powers, and obviously your opponent has relied on the Rostenkowski case, has indicated that that case said when you've got to start interpreting the rules of, for instance, the House or in this case, the state Senate, that you get into areas that violate the doctrine of separation of powers. How do you, if you can, distinguish the Rostenkowski case and distinguish what was going on in that case from what's allegedly gone on here?
There are several ways to distinguish that case. First of all, that court made very clear where a court can be confident of its interpretation of a legislative rule when applying it to the facts of a case. then there is no separation of powers problem. There is no justiciability problem. And that is the case we have here. The Senate rule that is being interpreted, the Senate guidelines say, one simple rule to remember, state offices and their supplies are not to be used for campaign activity. I don't know how much clearer that rule could be. It also goes on to say many of the same principles that apply to state supplies and equipment also apply to state employees and their activities on political campaigns. Again, I don't know how much clearer this rule could be. And as Justice Abrahamson, I believe, pointed out, in the Rostenkowski case and some of the other federal cases, the legislatures had not made a decision yet whether or not this activity was prohibited. The legislature in Wisconsin has made very clear that campaign activity is distinct from public duties and is highly regulated, as is evident by Chapter 11 and Chapter 12. And the Senate policy manual and Senate guidelines remind public officials in the legislature and public employees that this behavior is prohibited.
Counselor,
That's okay. Don't we have to draw lines then between what is legislative activity and what is political activity? And isn't that something that involves some real interpretation of what goes on in the Wisconsin legislature?
I don't believe that the court has to do that in this case. The facts of this case, as the Court of Appeals made very clear, the facts of this case are not close. They picked out several things that they said that under reasonable interpretations, that's a close call. We're not going to go there. We'll say that that's non-justiciable. But with respect to all of these other activities, which are pure campaign activities like fundraising, keeping fundraiser lists, doing campaign plans, soliciting people to run for office, those are purely campaign. Under any reasonable interpretation of the rule, this court can be confident that that is in fact prohibited, and therefore this is non-justiciable. So the court doesn't have to figure out where that line is drawn in this case, because it's very clear that under any reasonable interpretation of the rules and the statutes, let's not forget the statutes, because the rule is based upon the statutes, under any reasonable interpretation of political or campaign, these activities were prohibited by those statutes and by those legislative rules.
Counsel, what about the Orenstein case?
I'm glad you raised the Orenstein case, Justice Abrahamson, because I was under the impression from reading Senator Koala's brief that that was the last decision issued by the court of the courts in New York, and I that was my own error because I failed to recognize that the Court of Appeals in New York is the highest court. And in the Court of Appeals decision, the final decision on Orenstein, the court made very clear that that decision, well, let me read to you what the court said. They said, the point we are making in this case is that at the time the defendants acted, their conduct was not prohibited in any manner, nor could they have known that they were subject to criminal prosecution for their acts. There was no statute nor any rule or regulation defining the duties of the legislative assistants or limiting the nature or extent of their permissible political activities. Our holding is a narrow one based on circumstances which no longer exist. It is only fair to note that those who engage in such conduct in the future will not be able to make the arguments we find determinative here in the event they are criminally prosecuted. So, again, this was a case where the legislature had...
That if you have it in your brief, then you don't have to give it to me here.
I don't have that. I don't have it in my brief. I have the Northeast site. It's 565...
Okay.
Northeast 2nd, 493, and that's specifically at page 500.
Thank you.
You know what troubles me about Orenstein, if we might talk about that for a minute, is my understanding is that the court was saying that one of the reasons they upheld the dismissal of the charges was that there was no law expressly or by court interpretation prohibiting the activity. Now, when I think about that in terms of this situation, what law is there that expressly or by court interpretation says that you can use 946.12.3 and charge a felony for violation of these duties or rules? I know we're moving over, and I'm having trouble with that. We're moving over into the area of fair notice or due process or vagueness. But it's almost impossible when you start talking about Orenstein not to talk about that.
Yes, and I'm not trying to avoid the vagueness issue. I'm not understanding the court's concern with respect to Orenstein. There is nothing that says that there's nothing that says that 946.12 subsection 3 can be that you can look at other statutes to define duties, but that is what the defendants themselves are arguing, that nothing prohibits what they've done, and so they didn't have notice, and therefore the statute is vague. Well, in fact, there are numerous statutes which prohibit what they did, and so they can't have it both ways. They can't both say that there's nothing, there's no statute which prohibits this, and also say you can't look at statutes that prohibit this.
But as Justice Rogensack was pointing out, a lot of those statutes result in the possibility of either a forfeiture or, in some instances, a misdemeanor conviction. But none of them make the jump to felony.
Correct. And they are misdemeanors for violations of the statutes in themselves. But when you violate the felony misconduct statute, which has different elements than each of the other statutes, when you invoke the power of your office for a dishonest advantage, then you are allowed to charge a felony. For example, with respect to 19.45, subsection 5, that gives a public official the duty to refrain from using public position for unlawful benefits, advantages, privileges. There could be a situation where the Secretary of the Department of Public Instruction is stopped for speeding on the Beltline. And when she hands over her license, she also hands over her state official ID. And the officer lets her off because she is a public official. She is invoking the name or the specter of her office in order to gain an unlawful advantage, to get out of a speeding ticket. But she's not exercising any discretionary powers. Now, on the other hand, if the Secretary of the Department of Transportation is stopped for speeding and tells the state patrol, if you give me a ticket, I will fire you, he is actually invoking the powers that have been entrusted to him with the intent to gain a dishonest advantage. So I think it's a more serious breach of the fiduciary duty or the public trust in those two circumstances. So there are different ways to violate these different statutes. The fact that something might be criminal under more than one statute does not mean that the felony misconduct statute is vague or inconsistent or anything like that. And, in fact, other criminal statutes can be used for the basis of a misconduct statute. The Tronca case was a very good example. The defendants in that case committed bribery. They were charged with misconduct in public office. Yes, bribery is a felony, but when they've taken it to the level of using their office as they did, as corruptly as they did, it was appropriate to charge them with a felony.
Counselor, you know, you rely heavily on the Senate rules. But from everything I've read and what's been provided in both of these cases, this was not something that a lot of people were unaware of in the Senate.
Not unaware of in the Senate, certainly, although there were
I want to ask you a question about that. So if they were not unaware of it in the Senate and it's a violation of the Senate rule, and if the Senate can change their rules whenever the Senate decides to change their rules, why should this court get involved in enforcing a felony conviction based on rules of the Senate where the Senate hasn't chosen to prosecute what you're telling us is a violation of their own rules?
Again, it's not merely a prosecution based on the rules of the Senate. Those rules are based on statutes. And it is the duty of the executive branch to enforce criminal statutes, and that is what is happening here. And that's all the judiciary is asking, or all the executive branch is asking here, is for the opportunity to prosecute a criminal case. Yes, it so happens that as part of the prosecution, we will be introducing evidence of a Senate rule, but that doesn't mean that this prosecution is violative of the separation of powers doctrine. That was made clear by Rostenkowski. They said, of course, you can look at legislative rules in determining what the authority was with respect to a theft count against a legislator. I don't think the court is usurping the ability of the legislator to discipline its members, but the fact that this activity was ongoing for so long was in violation of the Senate policy rules and statutes, and nobody did anything about it, suggests that the executive branch was needed to enforce the criminal laws in this case. And it may be a situation where Senator Koala had accumulated so much power that nobody was willing to cross him, and they could not go through the normal process of disciplining members.
Well, another interpretation might be that those people in the legislature didn't enforce it because they weren't themselves sure where the line was between what was appropriate to do and what was not appropriate to do. And I refer you to opposing counsel's argument that when a candidate is elected, it is the ideas of that candidate that usually gains the candidate a seat in the legislature, and those ideas persist. And so it's hard to draw the line. You know, where is it okay to further ideas and where is it not okay to further ideas?
I don't understand defense's argument on that. We are not the prosecution in this case does not in any way infringe upon anybody's right to articulate ideas or get that message across to the public.
But just relies on the Senate rule. I agree with you if you look in a broader context. I was looking only at the rule and saying perhaps there's another reason that the Senate didn't enforce its own rules. Maybe its idea of where the line is different than yours, or maybe it doesn't have a clear idea of what it thought the line was when it did the rule.
That's a possibility, although I don't think that possibility is supported by the allegations in the complaint, because there were numerous allegations that, like, for instance, Senator Baumgart refused to talk to Joanna Richard, the director of the caucus, while she was on the state clock. Some of the other legislators said that they were under the impression that these people were being paid by a private campaign committee or using volunteer time. So clearly they recognized where the lines were and thought this was inappropriate. I see my time is up. May I just briefly conclude?
You may very briefly, and you still have another half hour.
Yes.
And we're all aware of that.
I would just conclude by asking this Court again to hold that 946.12 subsection 3 is not unconstitutionally vague, and the prosecution of the charged conduct does not violate either the speech or debate clause nor general separation of powers concerns. And we ask this Court to affirm the Court of Appeals decision. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Olson.
Yes, I'd like to respond to some of the comments that were made by the Attorney General. As far as the Attorney General seems to suggest that if the prosecution does not like the way the Senate is operating and does not like the way it is enforcing its own rules, then it's the job of the prosecutor to step in and interpret them for them. That is not the separation of powers. It's when one branch does not like the way another branch is doing things, it doesn't give them the right to step in and do it. I want to also talk about the Senate. What we're talking about is interpreting the Senate rules, not the Senate guidelines. The Senate rule is what the Senate adopted. And the Council keeps jumping into some Senate guidelines, which were apparently published by the Chief Clerk of the Senate, and were not the rules of the Senate.
What does the rule of the Senate say about campaigning?
It doesn't say anything about campaigning.
Okay.
If it had meant to say, just limit it to, it says political activity. If it had meant to say campaign, it would have said campaign. Now, as far as the statutes that the Attorney General was relying on, 1136, 1207, those seems to be the ones that she was primarily referring to, those say no person may do such and such. It doesn't say a state officer. And that is significant because under State versus Schmidt, that was a situation where a prison guard was indicted for misconduct in public office for having intercourse with an inmate, violating the fornication law. And the fornication law said no person may. And they said, when the statute says no person, that applies to all of us. That doesn't define a duty of the senator as an officer. When 1136 says no person shall do such and such a thing, that no person refers to you and everybody else. And so
That doesn't mean that a senator could not be prosecuted for it. But as Justice Robinsack was pointing out, then they would be prosecuted under the statute for a misdemeanor. And we say, if you believe we violate 11.36, then indict us under 11.36 and prosecute us for a misdemeanor. Don't try to make it into a felony by making a duty of an office a duty that everybody has. And that is part of 1946, is that it has to be a duty which is a duty of your office, not a duty that you have, is that for everyone. Finally, as far as Orenstein is concerned, the appellate division portion that we relied upon went to the idea of speech and debate. And that was the closest case where we have where the idea of speech and debate is used, where a person, a member of the staff, has responsibilities that are both campaign and, in a broader sense, also political. And when those duties, when they have both those duties, the court said, we cannot inquire into what that person is doing, because to do so would violate the speech and debate, because we are then inquiring into what the person is doing, which is part of the political process. And they can't even do an inquiry into that regard, because there is a privilege which is raised by the senator. And in this case, it is clear that the state has confused some of the processes, because the Court of Appeals said you're wrong. There are some of these things that are justiciable and some that are not. And the things that are not justiciable, you can't inquire into those. And you can't inquire into them. And, in fact, the complaint shows that they already have. What shows that this statute, or not the statute, excuse me, what shows that the Senate policy manual is ambiguous, the best proof that there is that the Court of Appeals and the Attorney General have interpreted it differently as far as the various acts are concerned.
Counsel, just for clarification, and I'm looking at your brief, your opposing counsel notes that you cite as precedent the lower court decision in Orenstein. Is that correct?
Yeah, the appellate division.
Mm-hmm. And so you're not citing the court of last resort in Supreme Court.
The best court of last resort affirmed on other grounds and did not deal with the issue of speech and debate because they found another grounds upon which they could affirm the lower court. But both the trial court and the appellate division found that people who have mixed responsibilities, like all the people in this case, that when they have mixed responsibilities, the speech and debate clause prevents inquiring into them as to what their job duties are. Your Honor, that concludes my comments.
Brooks has a question.
Okay.
Since you're getting into the speech and debate clause, I can't help but ask this question. I know that there is one case, at least one case I came across, that interprets that particular clause, State versus Beno, which I believe the Chief Justice wrote. And it's my understanding of that case that it indicates that legislators are protected from what they say, for instance, on the Senate floor, for what they say during debate, but that doesn't stop prosecution for other violations. Do you have any response to that? It strikes me speech and debate doesn't really relate to this.
Oh, yeah. Speech and debate, as the Beno court said, relates to anything which is integral to the legislative process. And furthermore, it also relates to activities done by legislative aides. And it's our position that what these people that worked for the Senate caucus did was integral to the legislative process, and therefore they cannot be questioned about what their activities are. And because of the fact that there is no definition as far as what their working hours are, and you have to go into the idea of compensatory time, any questioning of these people at the during the trial would involve a violation of the speech and debate clause.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Olson, and thank you, Ms. Oswald, for your arguments in this case. And that will conclude our arguments in this case, and we'll move on to our second case. I'd just like to ask the Deputy Marshal, do we have to give any time for a movement of the classes? Pardon me?
No.
Everything's okay? All right. We will move right into our second case. Thank you.